truth is, sometimes it's what's not in the economic numbers that makes them really interesting. Today's case in point, inflation from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 22nd of May. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. We have, I believe, declared inflation dead on this program a good number of times. Still is. Don't get me wrong. Not changing my forecast to get all economist on you here. But my obligations as a business journalist do pretty much require me to give you the headline economic number of this Friday, the CPI, as it's known, the Consumer Price Index. Inflation, such as it is at the retail level. 0.1%, a tenth of 1% is how much prices went up last month. That's the top line number. Core inflation, that's just minus food and energy, rose 0.3%. So dead, as I said. But there is a lot that is and isn't in that number that does give it some extra oomph. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons gets us going.
Don't get the wrong idea. The Consumer Price Index is a very important measure of inflation. It looks at the prices of a bundle of items and measures whether those prices are going up or down. Steve Reed, an economist with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says the CPI is used to adjust rent and wages.
It's used in private contracts to escalate values of money. Well, it's used by the government in many official ways, such as to adjust Social Security and so forth.
That's why it's seen as a stand-in for inflation for consumers. But the CPI isn't what the Fed uses to figure out whether the economy as a whole is experiencing inflation or deflation. They prefer the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or PCE. But Jeremy Siegel, a professor of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, says no matter what the measure, there's uncertainty.
And the reason for that is that when the price of one good goes up, we substitute other goods.
Like, if beef gets expensive, you'll probably just buy chicken.
But how much is almost as good is a value judgment.
And that's why the Fed tries to avoid that uncertainty by looking at the core PCE, which strips out the volatile prices of food and energy. The Fed is trying to influence the economy where it can, says Ben Friedman, an economics professor at Harvard.
They're letting the economy respond to movements up or down in oil prices rather than having monetary policy do that.
And as for that CPE number, that will be released on June 1st. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
This being a Friday and the economy being more than just indicators and statistics, we're going to take a couple of minutes now to unpack the past 5 days. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. She's in New York. Sudeep Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. He is down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Okay.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you very quickly on the CPI. Not why isn't there any inflation, but is there ever going to be inflation in this economy ever again?
There might be inflation sometime down the road, but we've been waiting for inflation for a very long time. And as you've noted, the Fed's most important gauge of inflation has not been at the Fed's target for almost 3 years. And so it's probably going to be a while before that measure gets closer to it. You are seeing inflation in some pockets of the economy. You're obviously seeing it in luxury housing, in art, in some other assets, but you're not really seeing a whole lot on the day-to-day things that we buy. And that's just an indication of the slack that's still out there in the overall economy.
Lee, let me turn to you and skip right past inflation with you and go to Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed, gave a speech today, went up to Rhode Island for some reason to do that, in which she basically said, yeah, you know, we could raise rates in this economy this year, maybe. anything surprising in what the Fed chair said?
Well, I mean, you know, this inflation number, the core number, not to get back on that, is
oh, no, go ahead, please. Do whatever you want.
It was the biggest rise since January 2013. And she did cite some positive things that are happening in the job market. There's more than 3 million jobs were added last year. The quit rate, which is a key indicator, is high. She singled those things out. And I think that there is a pretty strong likelihood that it's going to be, you know, is it going to be July or is it going to be September? That's now the big question. But I think she was actually a little more confident than wishy-washy.
I'm actually on record as saying it's going to be September. I think I'm going to push that to later in the year, but we can revisit at some other time. Sudeep, let me just ask you another question about not the Fed, but the employment market in this country. L.A., as you might have heard, raised the minimum wage here. It's going to happen in increments to $15 an hour. My question to you is,
LA's a big city, second biggest city in the country. It's sort of the latest big city to get on the minimum wage train. Do you think it now spreads where we see minimum wages going up across the country?
I think it will spread because they're going to see the signal from LA and from other big cities and states that have already raised the minimum wage. Half the states in the country are already above the federal minimum wage, and that's an important indication. It's also important that all of this is happening 6 years into an economic recovery. Mm-hmm. If it's taken this long for enough traction to build up for states to feel like it's okay to move in that direction in a way that won't demolish their own labor markets where they are and hurt their own economies. And it's probably not going to lead to widespread layoffs. There could be some effects around the edges, but that's probably a good sign for the economy when there is this much support across the country for higher wages at the bottom end.
Lee, talk to me about New York. I mean, if New York City and New York State go along, it's a whole different ballgame.
That's absolutely true. But I do think there's a lot of momentum here. I almost feel like the minimum wage movement is sort of where gay marriage was 18 months ago. Yeah. There just feels to be this momentum. The interesting thing about LA to me is that they are going to do something really innovative, which is publish a list of employers who have more than 100 employees on Medicaid. I mean, the thing that hasn't been talked about is how much employers have been relying on taxpayer money for public help to people who are not making a living wage. And that plus low oil prices, which we've had, has made it easier. So I think we will see more movement. Absolutely.
All right. We will see what happens. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, a little bumpy, a little choppy, some zigs and some zags. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This next economic number might not rank up there with the CPI, but bear with me because you are gonna care. The Department of Agriculture said today that production of table eggs in this country off 0.6% last month. The proximate cause is that bird flu outbreak that's been getting worse almost by the day. Tens of millions of egg-laying chickens have been slaughtered to try to contain that epidemic, which has caused the aforementioned egg gap. The U.S. is trying to meet that demand by turning to the import market. The problem is our neighbors to the north and the south are doing the same thing. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
You may not know it, but we have an egg-tastrophe on our hands. Thanks to bird flu, we have killed an estimated 31 million chickens. That's 10% of the country's egg-producing poultry.
And when you take 10% out of any equation, it becomes a big deal.
Randy Pesciotta is the vice president of the egg department at Urner Barry, a company that prices what we eat. He says, think about all the foods eggs are in.
In pasta, in mayonnaise, in ice cream, in eggnog.
Pesciotta says prices for wholesale eggs have almost doubled. So he says the first customers to feel the price increase are going to be food manufacturers. Phil Lumpert is an industry analyst.
About 25% of McDonald's sales rest in breakfast.
Lumpert says McDonald's is already dealing with Taco Bell, trying to steal its breakfast business.
They cannot raise the price of their breakfast sandwiches.
It's not clear where companies like McDonald's can buy cheaper eggs. Not from Canada or Mexico. They were already buying eggs from us. There is talk of getting exports from the EU, but Randy Pesciotta says there's a problem.
They produce to their set of rules. We produce to our set of rules. They're different.
In the U.S., producers wash and refrigerate eggs to protect against salmonella. But the EU vaccinates its chickens and says washing can damage shells, making eggs more vulnerable to bacteria. So until we can agree on exactly what makes eggs safe, we may have an eggpocalypse. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
IBM laid off a couple hundred people in Missouri a couple of weeks ago. That didn't sit too well with officials there who suspended incentives worth about $10 million to IBM because they say the company hadn't kept its promise to keep at least 500 jobs in state. Other states are looking hard at those kind of incentives as well. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has more now on this economic game of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
States want jobs. Companies want a good deal. To win business, states have used economic incentives. Josh Goodman is senior researcher with the Pew Charitable Trust Economic Development Incentives Project.
Collectively, states spend billions of dollars each year on incentives.
But sometimes business is bad, or a company can't find the skilled labor it needs. Or there's a recession, and instead of new jobs, there are layoffs. So a state says, hey, we want our money back. It's called a clawback.
A clawback is a contractual safeguard that a state or local government would put in place when it gave a tax break or other incentive to a company to protect taxpayers.
Greg LaRoy is executive director of Good Jobs First, a group that promotes accountability in economic development. A lot of times, though, these contracts are, as LaRoy puts it, mushy.
They give too much wiggle room or discretion to commerce departments to not enforce the clawback.
Rob Greenbaum teaches public finance at Ohio State. He says states often aren't that diligent about tracking to see whether companies have made good on their promises. Or, Greenbaum says, it's about saving face.
Possibly the local leaders who forged the deals might not want to publicize that they forged a deal that wasn't successful.
And when business takes a nosedive, there is no money to take back. So many states are setting performance-based incentives. Instead of getting money up front, companies have to meet specific targets first. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Workout clothes used to be just for the gym, but apparently that's not the case anymore. Yoga pants as fashion statement, I guess. It's a style called athleisure. It is also, of course, a big business opportunity. Elizabeth Holmes writes about fashion and style for the Wall Street Journal. Hey.
Hi, Kai.
Tell me what this is, this athleisure thing.
Well, if you are walking around the sidewalks or the mall or pretty much any part of the country, you might notice a lot more women and men look like they've either just come from a workout or are headed to a workout. Leggings and tank tops and sneakers are sort of taking over the style masses. But you don't actually have to work out in them. For a lot of people, this is sort of their everyday casual look.
And is it because it's comfortable and they're being made more stylishly these days? Is that sort of it?
It's sort of this trifecta of trends that we don't see very often. It kind of bubbled up from the masses. So Lululemon made yoga pants appropriate in non-yoga settings. And then the mass retailers really sort of took hold of this because of the comfort factor. And then high fashion made it stylish. You know, we saw sneakers on the runway and sweatshirts. And so suddenly all these different parts of the fashion food chain are participating in the same trend. So that's sort of why we see it as peak athleisure moment, that everybody's doing this their own way, and it can look pretty good, and it's also super comfortable.
Well, all right, can look pretty good. I mean, a pair of leggings is a pair of leggings is a pair of yoga pants is a pair of yoga pants, right? I mean, come on, you're not fooling anybody.
Well, then you talk to Bergdorf's and say some of their strongest selling athleisure gear is a pair of $400 leggings from a UK label called
$400?
Lucas Hughes. Yes. So women are justifying this purchase by saying, hey, this is not just something I'm wearing to sweat in, but it's something I'm going to brunch in. And so they're getting more than one wear out of it, and suddenly it's replacing their skinny jeans.
It's not just the Bergdorf's and the retailers. It's like Nike's getting into this and Under Armour. I mean, they're all capitalizing on this trend.
Yes, part of why I think this trend has gotten so big is that every apparel brand out there sees a piece of this pie. So if you're a traditional sort of fitness, performance-based company like Nike, you can infuse a little bit more fashion and suddenly attract a broader customer base. Or if you're a fashion brand and you think, hey, I can make something in spandex, and so suddenly they're offering these like sports collections that offer, you know, maybe you could work out in them if you wanted to, but you don't have to. And so everybody sees this as an opportunity to kind of jump on and make their own version, and they know that a lot of customers don't already have this stuff in their closets.
You don't suppose people are actually working out and then just throwing on a blazer and a pair of booties and going to brunch, do you? I mean, they're aren't they showering and going home and changing, or no? Or is that kind of defeating the purpose?
I will say that I do know some women who don't necessarily shower between workout and brunch. And it's because some of these boutique fitness places, a lot of them don't have locker rooms with showers. And so they can kind of like yeah, they can kind of wipe down a little bit. Like, wow. If you have a really sweaty tank top, you're, of course, going to want to ditch that.
Of course.
But if you put on a new tank top and then a sweater and then a leather jacket on top of that.
Boom, you're done.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure I totally support this trend, but I know that a lot of people are doing it.
You're just the reporter, man. You're just the reporter. Elizabeth Holmes at the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
You need some ridiculous thing to happen to justify having come here if you can't get a great movie.
The Cannes Film Festival minus the great movies. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 53 points today, almost 0.3%, closed at 18,232. The NASDAQ gave back a point, just a fraction of a percent, 5,089. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.2%, ended things at 21.26. For the week gone by, the Dow off 0.2%, the NASDAQ up 0.8%, the S&P 500 up 0.2%. Let me ask you something. Has it been a while since you've seen an ad for a V8 or Prego or Goldfish or Pepperidge Farm? If so, not your imagination. Campbell's Soup owns all those brands and says it's been doing less marketing as a way to offset declining revenue. Investors don't really seem to mind that strategy. Go figure. Campbell's shares up 2% today on profit news. Investors continue to buy up Time Warner Cable on speculation it will eventually, somehow, someday, be a takeover target. Shares in ticker symbol TWC up 3.4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The markets and most government agencies will be closed in observance of Memorial Day. Use this time to celebrate the 80th anniversary of Babe Ruth's 714th home run. But if you're looking to just relax, hang out, and watch a movie, may I suggest Star Wars? The first of George Lucas's blockbuster saga hit theaters on this day in 1977. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you saw up at the top of the broadcast with today's report on inflation and how there isn't any yet, the number itself still does matter. There is lots of stuff in business and the economy that sometimes doesn't make a lot of sense, which makes it handy that we've got a series designed specifically to answer whatever questions you might have along those lines. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blatant.
This week's question comes courtesy of listener Eileen Lee.
Why is it that every once in a while, my favorite brand of shampoo, food, or drink gives me an extra 20% free? Why would a company do this?
Why indeed? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on it.
Eileen Lee is a statistician and demographer, a grad student, finishing up and publishing her master's thesis. She's a very careful shopper, not afraid to do the math, dissecting special offers and deals. She's very particular. For example, her chicken nuggets have to be dinosaur-shaped. Why?
I like biting the heads off.
I see. Oh, my. Eileen and I are on a virtual shopping date. I'm at my favorite store in Wheaton, Maryland, just outside Washington. She's at a store near L.A., where she's from. We head to the shampoo aisle. Eileen spots a get-more-free deal right away.
Yeah, organics. They have some oil of Morocco shampoo, and it's 50% more free.
So will she buy it?
No, I've used their stuff before. I don't like it. It makes my hair feel weird.
Yep, I told you she was particular. Eileen's got a brand of shampoo she likes and sticks with. Ditto for toilet paper, detergent. We go down aisle after aisle looking for a get-more-for-less deal she likes. We don't find any. Hence, her question.
What made me ask the question was that I never fall for that. Like, I see extra 20%, and if it's not the same brand I've been using or the same series of brands, then I wouldn't even think of choosing it.
So Eileen never goes for these deals. But turns out lots of other people do. That's part of the answer to Eileen's question. Let's leave the grocery store and talk to Ira Kalb. He teaches marketing at USC.
It gives you an effective discount that's very tangible and enables you to differentiate your product from the others on the shelf, and it sways people to your brand.
You want consumers to try it, get hooked on it. Pepsi was among the first companies to experiment with Get More for Free in the 1930s, according to Robert Schindler, a professor of marketing at Rutgers.
But they hit upon this idea that they would have a package twice the size, and they'd sell it for the same price as the Coke, which was a nickel. And then they promoted that with this radio jingle. Would you like me to sing it?
Absolutely.
Pepsi Cola hits the spot. 12 full ounces, that's a lot.
Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you.
Back in the grocery store, Eileen says I've answered her question, but she's still not interested in the get more for less deals. Now, manufacturer's coupons, that's different.
Because then I can actually calculate if it's actually cheaper, whereas with the 20% free, I have to calculate, okay, what was the normal price, and then am I actually getting more product, and then...
Sounds like an I've always wondered question for another day. In Wheaton, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We need you to make this series work, so please send us the things you have always wondered about. There's a spot on our website where you can do that. It's marketplace.org. The Cannes Film Festival wraps up this weekend. 2 weeks of seeing and being seen while going to and from seeing movies. Wesley Morris, the film critic at Grantland, is the guy we talked to about all things cinematic. He is in Cannes right now. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
Well, me, I'm sitting in L.A. You, on the other hand, are on the south of France watching movies. What's the vibe?
Well, the vibe is what happened to the movies.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. The vibe is... we saw Mad Max the first day,
yeah,
and we've been trying to see Mad Max ever since.
Oh, so that's the good one so far on the first day is Mad Max Thunderdome Redux or whatever the name of that thing is?
Yes. Here's the thing. It's not in the competition. They just showed it out of competition. And this year is one of the rare years where that movie, it's not the opening night movie, yeah, but it's the one that plays the next night. It was amazing. It is the best movie, and very little that we've seen since then has been as great, especially in the main competition.
Why is that? I mean, this is the film festival to end all film festivals.
Well, here's what I think happened. I mean, at least from my eyes, is that the financing for these movies has really compromised some of the artistic choices that a filmmaker can make, I think. And so you have money coming from all over the world, and it dictates certain things. Like if you're a Greek director and you're getting Irish money, then you have to take Colin Farrell with the money that you get, which has happened. It happened at a movie this year. And the movie actually turns out to be good. It's called The Lobster, and it's by Yorgos Lanthimos. And there are a number of other directors, maybe like six other directors, making movies for the first time, not in their native language. And the results are kind of mediocre. You wonder if that has something to do with it.
So I want to ask you actually about something I read up on your stuff on Grantland, your Cannes diary about film festivals writ large. You said, which 3-hour existential odyssey into the human soul do I want to see? Now, you guys are doing this like at 8:30 in the morning. How can you make sense of any of this stuff when it's all sort of in that vein, right?
Not, yes. I mean, typically, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of long movies where characters sit around and read the newspaper or sit in a car and watch other people do things. And, you know, there is a standard by which you evaluate whether or not they work. What's been interesting about this year is that even by the standards of watching a 3-hour movie in which theoretically nothing happens, but is also a masterpiece, there have been very few movies that have achieved that level of filmmaking.
Huh.
It's just been kind of lackluster.
I can't let you go without asking you about this whole thing with people not dressing right over there. Are you actually getting turned away from films if you don't have a jacket on and women have to wear heels and all this jazz? I mean, Cate Blanchett and all that?
It is. I mean, it is a thing. It is happening. It is a real thing. And I think it's not the scandal that people are making it out to be. All it's right. Not happening every night, but everybody's got a story about how it's happened to them or someone in their party, where you were denied entry because you were not appropriately dressed. And it has caused a great deal of consternation and a greater deal of comedy. It is one of the pleasures of coming to this festival. You need some ridiculous thing to happen to justify having come here if you can't get a great movie.
Wesley Morris, he writes on movies for Grantland. Thanks, Wesley.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, because A, it's Friday, and B, it's also Friday. Quick, what is the best-selling beer in the world? I'm just going to go ahead and assume you didn't guess snow. Bloomberg ranked the top 10 selling beers by market share in the world, and apparently one called Snow is all the rage in China these days, up just shy of 600% in the past decade. Number two is also Chinese, Qingdao, which is actually pretty good. Both can be tricky to find here in the States, so you're going to have to settle for numbers three or four, Bud Light and Budweiser in that order, which means right about here, I despair for humanity. The Dow off 53 points this Friday, almost 0.3%. The NASDAQ gave back a point, just a fraction of 1%, basically flat. The S&P 500 off 4 points, that is 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Orr. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here on Monday. If you got the day off, think about what it's about, though, would you? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.